and walked alongside, one hand on the hearse. I'm Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this Wednesday edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and it's certainly great to be along with you on the broadcast today. We're going to be talking about a lot of important issues that are in the news today. Our Wednesday program is billed as a Worldview Wednesday edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast, and as such, we look at a number of different items that are in the news, and we seek to bring a biblical or Christian worldview to bear on those issues. And so we're looking to do that on today's program as well. We're going to start off the program with Emily Bells from World Magazine. And I wanted to talk with Emily about a couple of stories that she has written about recently. First up, I wanted to ask her about the fact that evangelicals seem to be ratcheting up some pressure on President Obama in order to expand the health care law conscience clause. And so we want to talk about that. Emily has written a little bit about another story. This one has a little bit more of an international flair to it, but at one time, it was thought to be completely lost, but now the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedoms, it actually won a reauthorization in Congress, and so I want to talk a little bit about that. And then finally, a little bit about an interesting story or a movie that has come out, and I just want to get her thoughts on that story. The story or the movie is entitled War Horse. You probably have seen some of the clips from that. It seems to be a really well-told story. Seems to be an interesting story in the theaters, even right now. I think it's been released already. And it's quite a beautifully shot, epic picture. But some have spoken about it as being a little bit slow-paced, and so we want to talk about that on the program here as well. So that's what's up for our first half an hour of the program today with Emily Bells. At the bottom of the hour, we're scheduled to touch base with Steve Dace from Iowa, a nationally syndicated talk show host there in Iowa. And I wanted to talk with Steve Dace about a couple of items. One, he just hosted what was referred to as a personhood presidential forum, and so we want to get his thoughts about that. Second, Steve Dace has just released a book, and so I want to talk with him. It just came out, I think, on December 1st, and the book is entitled We Won't Be Fooled Again, and talking about the religious right and kind of being in the pocket of the GOP for many years and how we felt burned by that over the last few presidential elections. And so we want to talk to him a little bit about that book. And then third, we want to get him to give us the latest snapshot from Iowa. Of course, he has his finger on the pulse there, probably like nobody else from a Christian perspective anyways, in Iowa as to what's taking place. I think Ron Paul is still leading the pack in most of the surveys and polls that I see, but I want to get his take on what's taking place there in Iowa. And so we're scheduled to be joined by him. Of course, things are happening fast and furious there in Iowa, so that could change. A lot of things going on there. We just hope that his schedule still allow him to join us at the bottom of the hour. Let's start with Emily. Emily, it's a pleasure to have you back here on the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Emily, let's talk about that first story that I mentioned there, the conscience clause in the health care law. You wrote a little bit about that as a web extra piece out on www.worldmag.com. Tell us a little bit about what's taking place with that conscious clause.
Well, usually you think of Catholics as the ones that are really strongly opposed to the contraceptive mandate in the new health care law. But an evangelical college just sued the Obama administration over that issue because they said they oppose funding abortive patients in their health care plans.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened right before Christmas.
So does it only include contraceptives, or when we use that term, does that include things like a pharmacist maybe being required to dispense the morning after pill? Are you, 46? Or, you know, those types of items as well?
Yeah, the mandate covers all FDA-approved contraceptives, which includes Plan B, or the morning after pill, and Ella, which can kill an embryo up to a week after intercourse. So, obviously, evangelicals would consider that abortion in a lot of cases. So it's not just the Catholic Church that opposes that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the unprecedented part of this was the fact of evangelicals being a part or joining in with the Catholic League and other groups in order to have a united front here about opposing this particular aspect of the healthcare law.
That's right. It's a pretty wide range of evangelicals, too. It's not just Focus on the Family or the Family Research Council. It's also Evangelicals for Social Action, which you would think of as maybe a more left-leaning group. There was a letter that went to President Obama protesting this mandate, and it included that whole array of evangelical groups. So I think there is a lot of pressure on him now.
Mm-hmm. Were they concerned that if they didn't oppose this, that in some way it could be made much broader? It could kind of lay the groundwork for a much broader application?
Yeah, I think these groups see it as an imposition on their religious freedom. I mean, it's an imposition on their constitutional protections. And so if they don't fight this, you know, what else is going to come down the line that would be mandated by the federal government? So I think it's part of the whole picture of how do we maintain those broad protections for religious freedom that are in the Constitution.
Do you see any sort of a trend here that evangelicals are getting more involved in life-related issues beyond just specifically the issue of abortion?
Yeah, I think, under this administration, it's really united Catholics and evangelicals in terms of conscience protections especially. We've seen that in the courts, but we've also seen that at the administrative level. Kathleen Sebelius, who's the Secretary of Health and Human Services, said that covering these contraceptives is the equivalent of covering flu shots. She sees it as just basic health care. And I think evangelicals and Catholics together want to make sure that we're not defining something that religious groups disagree about as a basic part of healthcare.
Mm-hmm. I think the religious groups that you spoke about, which included Evangelicals for Social Action, Focus on the Family, Prison Fellowship, and many others, including the Council of Christian Colleges and Universities, which represents 137 Protestant schools, were all involved in this. Apparently, they don't see these things as basically a flu shot. They see these contraceptives as including infanticides as well. Is that correct?
That's right. And, the White House has indicated that they might consider expanding the protection for religious groups, in other words, allowing them to opt out of that mandate. But right now, that mandate covers everyone except churches, pretty much. So it's very, very narrow. Mm. It would exclude most of the things you would think of as faith-based.
Mm. Now, I don't know if it's just me, and I've just noticed this with the health care law because it's been in the news so much, or if this is standard policy for a number of other government regulations or legislation. But it seems that there's an awful lot of opting out that is needed with this particular health care law. It seems to be convoluted and complex. Some people are mandated that they have to be in. Others, a whole slew of groups had tried to opt out of various aspects of this, and now this is just the latest one. I don't know who can keep track. It takes a bureaucracy in order to keep track of who's in and who's out. Am I right in concluding that this particular law, we have seen this at an unprecedented level of opting in and opting out?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, and that's exactly the argument that these Christian schools are making in court, is that that Congress allowed all of these exemptions and opt-outs for various groups like teachers' unions and McDonald's and all these things for the healthcare law, but they didn't provide opt-outs for religious groups, which have specific protections in the Constitution. So it's interesting that these court arguments are going back to what you were just saying, that opt-outs have been provided to everyone essentially except religious groups.
Hmm. What's the likelihood of the group that has launched this this suit? Of them actually winning the suit? What's your sense? Will they, because of the sheer numbers of those that are involved in it, is the likelihood of it passing, or is the likelihood that it's going to be shot down because it would exclude such a large group of people?
Yeah, it's really hard to say, but I think the fact that now two major schools have filed suits against the administration on this, the administration at least feels pressure to make a decision on whether to expand those protections for religious groups. So you might see that the White House decides to expand those protections before the court can take action. But they have a good bit of time to figure that out, at least until August of next year.
Mm. Well, we'll keep an eye on that and see where that goes. Let me remind our listening audience, we're speaking with Emily Bells from World Magazine. And you can go out and check out not only this story that we're talking about, but many others out on www.worldmag.com. That's www.worldmag.com. This was in the Web Extra piece, and so they add a lot of other content out there on the website besides what you get in the actual print version of the biweekly magazine that comes out. And I highly recommend that the folks in our listening audience sign up for that. The actual print version is great, comes every other week. And I know that we're in a constant race there to the mailbox with a couple of the residents of my household as we seek to who's going to be the first one to get to read it when it comes in the mailbox. So let me just remind the listening audience of that. Emily, I wanted to switch gears slightly and talk about another story that's out there as well. Tell us a little bit about what's taking place with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. What's recently taken place regarding that issue or that that aspect, and what's taking place in Congress?
Yeah, so the U.S. government has pretty limited resources on what it uses to monitor religious freedom abroad, and the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom is one very small arm that helps monitor those religious freedom abuses. But it was just hours from being shut down right before Congress left town for the holidays, and they approved it in a last-minute vote. So it's reauthorized for a few more years, and they'll keep traveling the world and monitoring religious freedom. But we really thought that we had lost it there for a little while.
Does it basically report on abuses to religious freedom around the globe? And if so, how often does it report on that? Is it like a monthly report, or as events take place? How does that work with them?
Yeah, the commissioners travel around the world, and then they issue an annual report. But they also do a lot of media stuff where they'll, you know, issue statements on, let's say, the Nigeria bombing that happened over Christmas. They would issue a statement on that and pressure the State Department to do, to take action and things like that. So they're a voice to monitor religious freedom abuses, but they also pressure the State Department.
Mm-hmm. To actually make either statements about it or to get involved in the various situations that arise?
Right, exactly. And because the State Department doesn't really have a lot of resources to do this, this group is really one very important arm that that brings this issue to the forefront in U.S. policy.
Did we actually know who was behind allowing, you know, this commission to expire or to be no longer funded?
Well, yes. Senator Richard Durbin, who's a Democrat from Illinois and part of the Democratic leadership in the Senate, put a secret hold on the commission, and any senator can do that. But he had done that for several months. I mean, the House had approved almost unanimously the reauthorization of the commission back earlier in late summer, and then it sat in the Senate with his hold on it for several months until we thought it was going to expire. But he took his hold off at the last minute.
Did he give any reasoning for putting it on hold? I mean, this is not for any particular religious group, but religious groups, a broad spectrum of them. Did he give any sort of reasoning or justification for wanting to, you know, put a hold on this?
He didn't. He did. It seems sort of strategic because he made a lot of changes to the bill right at the last minute. So the House essentially had to accept his changes or the commission would disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So he changed some of the structure of the commission and that sort of thing. But there were some rumors that he was trying to get money for a prison to be reopened in Illinois, but I don't know how true that is.
Mm. The commission, which I understand is made up of unpaid commissioners, however, of course, their trips around the world are covered, or their costs are absorbed by the commission itself. Is there any well-known evangelicals on that commission? I know that Richard Land had commented on this story, but are there well-known names of, you know, nationally known evangelicals that serve on this particular commission?
Well, Richard Land would be the primary one, and then Michael Cromartie served on the commission until recently, and he heads the Ethics and Public Policy Center here in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
But all of those commissioners are going to be rotated off in the next 90 days thanks to the changes that Durbin made to the bill. So they're going to have to get all new commissioners in the next few months.
Hmm.
So there's a chance for new evangelicals to come on there.
It seems even more important right now, this commission does, in light of the so-called Arab Spring, where we all of a sudden saw a dramatic rise in persecution against Christians, primarily around the globe, especially in these heavily Muslim-populated areas. Once things had changed and it seemed that more radical elements were getting more involved in the country, suddenly the attacks seemed to go up. Do you see it as being much more important now than it was, say, just a year or so ago?
Yes, certainly. And the commission's been pretty vocal on those religious freedom abuses that happened during the Arab Spring. And the State Department, too, actually, has been pretty vocal on those issues, and perhaps because of pressure from the commission. But they've talked about how persecution has risen as these democracy movements have started and said that, you know, democracy can move forward without infringing on the rights of religious minorities over there.
Mm. Well, let me switch gears, Emily, for the last item that I wanted to ask you about. You wrote a story, again, in the Web Extra section there of worldmag.com, entitled Reined In, and it deals with a movie that I've seen it being publicized, repeatedly on television about War Horse is the title of the movie. You say in the subtitle to your article, War Horse is well-told, beautifully shot, epic, but its slow pace causes it to drag at times. Obviously, you've had an opportunity to see the film. Tell us a little bit about it without spoiling it for many of the listening audience.
Yeah, it's a great movie. It's a very classically Steven Spielberg movie, warm and optimistic, even though it's dealing with World War One. It follows a horse around as he's taken into the cavalry in World War One, and how he goes to all these different characters, French grandfather and German soldiers, and anyway, you meet all these different people who are living through World War One. And it's a lot of fun. It's I would say it's 2.5 hours long, and it does move a little slowly, but that might be we might feel that way just because we're used to such fast-paced movies these days.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great film overall, I think.
I should tell the listening audience that not only did you write the review there under that Web Extra section called Reined In, but also Emily wrote an article entitled Horse of a Different Color, and in that the subtitle is interesting. They say that a war horse is not primarily a horse movie or a war movie. So is it more of a horse movie or more of a war movie?
Well, it's really focused on the characters that the horse meets. So the horse is more of a unifying thread for all these different characters in World War II. I mean, I would say it's more of a story about family and, how these families lived through World War I and the compassion that they showed in the middle of all that misery that happened then.
Mm-hmm. I'm like the worst possible person to comment on movies. I just don't go see very many of them. I don't know if I'm too cheap, that I don't pay the prices there in the theaters, or I'm always just think, well, I can wait. I'll wait till it comes out on DVD or whatever, and so I'm just terrible about being the person to review the movie when it first comes out. I hear there's a lot of talk now about The Hobbit, and I know this is probably anathema to many people, but I don't follow the whole trilogy there very well at all, and all of the characters. So anyways, I'm glad that you folks at World Magazine pick up the slack there for us and give us reviews like this about these things in our culture as well. Are you much of a movie person, or do you go just primarily so you could do these reviews for the magazine?
Yeah, I enjoy having a little break from politics every now and then. And, War Horse is the kind of movie you want to see on the big screen. So, you try to get out to the theater for that sort of thing.
Yeah, there does seem to be a couple of pretty decent ones that are out there now. So, Emily, thank you very much. Thank you for, during this Christmas season, joining us here on the Knowing the Truth radio program. I appreciate you doing so. And thank you very much for the work that you're doing there with World Magazine. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me again.
Okay. That was Emily Bells from World Magazine. We're going to go ahead and let me mention first that you can go out there to read the articles that we were just talking about, all three of the articles that we just mentioned a few moments ago. And all of them are compiled there for you out on World Magazine. That's www.worldmag.com. You can go out there and just click and read these articles for yourself, and you'll see the great job they do there. We're going to switch gears in just a moment. We're going to be speaking with Steve Dace from Iowa. And so you won't want to miss that. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
Since 1993, Auger Family Chiropractic has helped thousands of people just like you. Dr. Auger's office has helped them to discover a better way to experience health and healing. For over a century, chiropractic doctors have known that by God's design, the body possesses the ability to heal itself naturally. To learn how chiropractic adjustments enable the body to perform to its optimum and heal itself without the use of drugs or surgery, listen to Your Half Hour to Health with Dr. George Auger, Wednesday afternoons at 12:30 on Christian Talk 660.
One of the things most alarming to me about today's culture is how evangelicals are responding to attacks against them. Many believe that somehow just having one's heart in the right place is all that matters, that a passion for Jesus and the life of the mind are somehow mutually exclusive. But burning hearts are not nourished by empty heads. We must develop our minds if we are to sustain godly passion and to have a clear message. Hi, this is R.C. Sproul inviting you to the Ligonier Ministries 2012 National Conference in Orlando, March 15th through the 17th, as we consider the theme of the Christian mind. I'll be joined by Sinclair Ferguson, Robert Godfrey, Michael Horton, Steve Lawson, Al Mohler, Stephen Meyer, R.C. Sproul Jr., and Del Tackett. Call 800-435-4343 now to get the early bird rate or register online at ligonier.org. I hope to see you there.
It's great pizza for a great price. So pack up the family and head over to Stevie D's near Walmart on Woodruff Road in Greenville. At Stevie D's, you'll find friendly faces and at least a dozen pizzas out at all times. Or you can order a pizza. They'll make it fresh just for you at no extra cost. So visit Stevie D's today.
Hi, this is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and I want to take the time to thank John, Ruth, Carlos, and the good folks over there at Stevie D's Pizza for their support of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Well, I recently had a press release come across my desk. The headline said this, Personhood USA Presidential Forum asks hard questions of Republican presidential candidates. It's out of Des Moines, Iowa, and dated December 28th, 2011, it says this, four Republican candidates participated in a pro-life forum Tuesday night answering tough questions about pro-life issues. The National Presidential Pro-Life Forum was the first of its kind, focusing solely on the sanctity of life. The event was sponsored by several prominent pro-life organizations, including Personhood USA, a grassroots Christian organization providing assistance for state groups working to recognize the rights of every human being at every age, and Champion the Vote, an organization committed to actively advancing traditional values, co-sponsored the event, which had over 26,000 participants in a simulcast teletown hall. The forum was hosted by Steve Dace, a nationally syndicated radio host, and broadcast on his Salem Network program and 88 Bot Radio Network radio stations across the country. Joining us now is Steve Dace, that same nationally syndicated radio host. And, Steve, it's a pleasure to have you on the Knowing the Truth radio program.
Thank you very much, Kevin, for having me. I appreciate it.
Steve, wanted to get your thoughts on three different topics. One, first of all, I wanted to get your thoughts on the town hall that you hosted, kind of a postmortem afterwards. How did you think it went? Was there anything surprising to you when you hosted this great event?
I thought it went fairly well. I think it definitely served the process. And I think what's important here is that this is the first, and I think a crucial first step, in a process of Christians ceasing to be anti-abortion and becoming pro-life. Mm. And what I mean by that is we have spent, you know, I'm 38 years old. My mom became pregnant with me at 14, and this was right at the time of Roe versus Wade. She chose to have her baby. Other friends of hers that were pregnant out of wedlock did not. Mm. And so this is an issue that hits very close to home for me. Also, in my own family, I mean, a lot of these pro-life with exceptions Republican candidates would have no problem signing bills into law that would say that members of my own family don't have the inalienable right to life simply because they were not conceived in ideal circumstances. Mm-hmm. So I think ever since Roe versus Wade, What the church has sought to do in its activism is to regulate abortion. Mm-hmm. And that means that we've passed a lot of bills that the former Congressman Bob Dornan would say ends with the line, and then you can kill the baby.
Mm.
What we've got to get to is the point now where we are being pro-life. We are asserting the principle of our argument. See, the left asserts the principle of theirs. It's a woman's body. She can do whatever she wants. We need to assert the premise of our argument, which is she cannot do whatever she wants because it's not her body. That's a baby, not her. And I think when we do that, we win. When we argue the premise of the left's argument, that is, some babies really aren't worth protecting, some babies we can sacrifice on the altar of political pragmatism, we're actually arguing their point, and they win. So I think this was very important to get candidates on the record and not just debating each other about who's the most against abortion, who will sign abortion regulation bills, but rather who really is pro-life, meaning is that a baby, is it from God, or is it not?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with you. I was able to work together with Ligonier Ministries at the end of last year and worked with them to send a copy of R.C. Sproul's book on abortion, which he said is the moral issue of our times.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent a copy to every one of the people in Congress at the time. We wanted them to, again, as you were just saying, to look at this from a biblical perspective and not the way that it has migrated towards being looked at in the political arena. There were a couple of interesting things that happened around this issue and around the event that you hosted. One was that I noted that was Rick Perry seems to have changed his view. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Rick Perry was one of these pro-life with exceptions politicians, and again, maybe it's my personal family background. I kind of take exception to those exceptions. So on my program, I've always said there's no such thing as pro-life with exceptions. That's like being, I'm pro-marriage fidelity with exceptions, except Thursday nights from 2 to 4 a.m. I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if you're pro-life with exceptions, you're really pro-choice. You just want fewer choices than the pro-aborts want.
Mm-hmm.
And Perry was confronted about this with a question that Keith Mason from Personhood USA asked from our town hall audience. And he spoke very passionately, and really it was a compelling moment, frankly,
mm-hmm.
Where he talked about an encounter he had recently in Iowa with a woman named Rebecca Kiesling, who is a pro-life attorney, and she is a child that was conceived out of a rape. And she spoke to him one-on-one. He talked in depth about this encounter, how it really changed his heart, and that really led to him signing this pledge. And one of the things that I think, and I said this on my show after the town hall last night, Kevin, I think a lot of men, believing they're noble by saying when a woman is raped or is a victim of incest, that is such a violation of the most intimate aspects of her femininity, who am I who cannot walk a mile in her shoes to tell her what she should do in those situations? And I understand where that sense of nobility comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when a woman like Rebecca Kiesling comes up to a Rick Perry and says, hey, I'm one of those exceptions, and it almost gives a person who probably does have a strong pro-life moral conviction, almost it gives him permission to see beyond, am I sexist, am I misogynist, if I tell a woman she has to have this kid, and then it gives him permission to say, you know what, it's back to the original question again.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a baby or is it not? And if it is, then I have a sworn duty as an executive the chief executive officer of Texas, as someone that is running to be the chief executive officer of the United States, I have a sworn duty to protect that life.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree, and I think I heard Rick Perry summarize that, where the woman basically said to him, I was a product of a rape, my mother being raped, and she summarized it, or he summarized it, he retold it as, and my life has value. And so looking her right in the eye, and how could he then say that because the horrible event that took place, the solution to that event is then to cause another horrible event and take the life of an innocent individual. It doesn't make sense at all. And I agree with you that the way it's been positioned. Let me ask you about another interesting thing that has come out of this as well from Personhood USA, and that is the position of Ron Paul, who I think is still viewed as the leader of the Iowa caucus, leading in most of the polls. But Congressman Paul, who many people say is personally pro-life, has a bit of a conflicting view about federal versus states' rights on this issue. Explain that to our listening audience and where we stand on that right now.
The real conflict for Congressman Paul is that he and a lot of his adherents really detest the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. They don't like it. They think it's granted the federal government too much power. It's why in the past they've been on the wrong end of issues like the Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Acts. And it's because they detest the 14th Amendment. They think that essentially gives the federal government way too much sweeping power to initiate some variation of a police state. And so they're uncomfortable from their view arguing that the 14th Amendment grants the federal government the authority to enforce the inalienable right to life. Now, my reaction to that would be, well, first of all, what does the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution say in the Bill of Rights? It says that no person shall be denied life or property without due process of law. So we're back to the original question again. Is that child in the womb, is that a human person or is it not? Hence the term personhood.
Mm-hmm.
So even if they don't like the 14th Amendment, Kevin, they still have to deal, and so does frankly every other politician, still have to deal with the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution. Do we deprive that unborn person of their lives without due process of law? And I would make the argument that no, we do not. And this is also the argument that has been going on in Paul's camp from the beginning, which is what takes precedence, unalienable rights or states' rights? And at times the Paul people act as if amending the U.S. Constitution is like adding a book to the Bible, when in reality, you know, state constitutional amendments cannot pass without input from the states. If we have a constitutional convention, the states send their own electors. If we send the amendments to the states, a supermajority of them has to ratify it. I mean, the idea that amending the U.S. Constitution conflicts with states' rights and federalism, first of all, the people that invented federalism, our founding fathers, were the ones that came up with the amendment process in the first place, so that's self-contradictory. And secondly, it's ironic to hear the people that are arguing for too much government assert that any government has rights. States do not have rights. No government has rights in our system. People, individuals, have rights.
Mm-hmm.
And states have duties and obligations, and the state's duties and obligations is to protect, as our Declaration says, those God-given rights. That's why governments are instituted among men. So no government, as Rick Santorum has said many times, no government has the right to do that which is wrong, whether it's your city commission, county board of supervisors, your state legislature, or the United States Congress. So I think that is the issue for the Paul people, is they're always concerned about encroaching federal power, and I share that concern, but then we as Christians need to understand that the role of government is to be the civil magistrate, to prosecute the natural law, the divine law, and to uphold our God-given rights. So it's not encroachment. This is what I find ironic, is a lot of Paul's people are staunchly right-to-work people. That's another issue I support.
Mm-hmm.
So they want a federal right-to-work law. They want a federal law that says no state can force you to join a union if you don't want to. Okay, but we can have a federal right to work law, but we can't have a federal law that says no state can kill babies if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, but as a Christian, that just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why Paul struggles to make major inroads with social conservatives.
Yeah, he's launched quite a campaign here in South Carolina to really go after the evangelical vote. And most of that is by playing ads that tell just how pro-life he is. And so those ads are running constantly here in South Carolina. But I think that people don't realize that his view is inconsistent with the Christian position on abortion, as you just articulated. It's actually inconsistent with libertarian as well. I read on the Libertarian Party website the other day, it says this concerning abortion. It says, recognizing that abortion is a sensitive issue and that people can hold good faith views on all sides, we believe that the government should be kept out of the matter, leaving the question to each person for their own conscious consideration. Well, that's anathema, obviously, to any Christian conservative, and yet he seems to be trying to straddle this fence between being somewhat pleasing to the libertarians on one side and yet claiming some sort of a Christian mantle on the other side as well, and I think that's becoming a glaring omission on his part or an inconsistency on his part. Let me ask you a third thing I wanted to ask you. This, the event that you hosted, really highlights, I guess, then Michelle Bachmann, at least with this issue, as being probably the most appealing candidate on the issue of life. Would you agree?
I think she has the most consistent record when you look at how she's voted and who she has endorsed. Rick Santorum's been a champion of the issue his entire career, but you still have to recognize that he has, over the course of his career, in primaries or in general elections, endorsed numerous pro-abort rhinos. I mean, there's just no other way around that. I mean, that's just the truth. But I think the most consistent on the issues, on this issue, and frankly, the issues across the board, has probably been Michelle Bachmann.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that really her views really get highlighted when this is part of the discussion, which for me, any candidate who is not pro-life, and pro-life in the way that we're talking about, to me, is an immediate disqualification. If your solution is to an unwanted pregnancy that we should take the life of the baby, you have forfeited any reasonableness or common sense whatsoever, and I couldn't trust you with any other issue. So I think that is vitally important, and I hope it results in a fresh look at the Bachmann candidacy as well. Let me ask you about a second thing. I understand you just released a brand new book called We Won't Get Fooled Again, Where the Christian Right Went Wrong and How to Make It America Right Again. We don't have much time, but let me give you an opportunity to give us a synopsis of what you write about in that book.
What I wrote about in the book is that if you look at the 30 years of Christian political activism within the Republican Party, all of the issues, this is not good news, but if we look at this objectively, all of the issues that we got into the political system to address are all much worse off than they were 30 years ago across the board. And so if God's word does not return to him void, then that's not a him problem, that's an us problem. And we have to consider the means and the methodology by which we've been trying to carry out the word of God. And I think it's pretty clear after interviewing over a dozen religious right leaders for the last 3 years that whether they agreed with us or didn't agree with us, I do think this is pretty clear if you read the book, is that the Christians chose to make a Faustian bargain for a seat at the political party table of the Republican Party,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to driving the issues. And I go to what happened with this Personhood town hall last night as a tremendous example. Just 6 weeks ago, the people at Personhood were losing in Mississippi, and the New York Times had a front page feature quoting other pro-lifers like Jim Bopp at National Right to Life, claiming that Personhood was destroying the pro-life movement.
Hmm.
And now, 6 weeks later, here they have a town hall with candidates. They get candidates like Rick Perry to improve their own standard.
Yes.
And how did that work? It worked because they didn't negotiate for a seat at Caesar's table. They said, this is the standard. This is what God compels me to do. As Luther once said, here I stand. I can do no more. May God have mercy on my soul. That it is your duty as the candidate. I'm the boss here. This government begins with we the people. So it is your duty as the candidate to measure up to my standard, which is God's standard. And if you do, I'll support you. And if you don't, I won't. And lo and behold, just like when we do this with our own children, what did these candidates do? They signed this pledge, which is the most pro-life mainstream pledge I have ever seen, and we got them to raise their standard. When we put issues above political party and above any other allegiances, Christians are at their best, Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care if it's evangelizing, witnessing, discipling, whatever aspect it is of the Christian walk, we are at our best when we stand for a transcendent absolute truth and compel the system to raise the standard to ours or respond to it, as opposed to when we take a look at two flawed paradigms and say, hey, which of these two can I most contort my own faith into enough of a pretzel to justify being a part of the groupthink?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we did that for 30 years, and we lost. And I think this Personhood USA town hall we had last night and the approach that was taken, to me, is an archetype of what we need to do in the future, which is, this isn't about a seat at the table. I don't need to come to your banquets. I don't want to hear your speakers. I've got my own family. God's got other things for me to do. I don't need this to be like high school where I feel like I'm involved and I'm one of the popular kids.
Mm-hmm.
What I need you to do is honor your oath of office and keep your promises to me as my elected representative. And if you do, you're going to love me. And if you don't, I'm going to fire you. I mean, that's really what we've got to get back to.
Mm. Practically speaking, in the actual races that are taking now, does that flesh itself out as being more actively involved in the primary process?
Yes.
And what does it look like after the primary is over? Most people then use this commonly used phrase, well, we have to select the lesser of two evils. What does that look like in both the primary process and afterwards?
Well, those are two salient questions, and they go right to the action point at the end of our book, the conclusion. And to me, the primary becomes the election now for Christians, Kevin. I think that is the election. Mm. I think depending on who wins primaries really determines whether the general election ultimately matters or not. I know there are people listening right now, and some folks, and I run into this here in Iowa and around the country where I broadcast. Some Christians act as if being a Republican is like being a Baptist, okay? Mm. And I'm sorry, but that's just not true. I mean, I'm not going to give an account to the chairman of the Republican National Committee when my time on earth is at an end.
Yes.
And I think that we have got to get involved in primaries, and the primary cannot be about who can win. It needs to be about who should win.
Mm-hmm.
That's the question we need to be asking ourselves. And we need to fight like crazy in these primaries, because I don't think any Christian can argue with me that we have substantially more righteous government under George W. Bush than we did under Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, I hate to say this, Bill Clinton's second term with the Republican Congress was one of the most conservative presidential terms we've had since probably pre-Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
Welfare reform, the Defense of Marriage Act, the crime bill, I mean, those are some pretty conservative reforms that we had under President Clinton with Speaker Gingrich and Majority Leader Dole working against and for one another.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we've got to critically think this, get very involved in primaries, and then if your person doesn't win in the general election, then I think it's up to every Christian to act on their own moral conscience.
Mm-hmm.
I think then if you can find, and I think when we argue how much evil can I accept, we've already lost.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the argument needs to be Christians are to advance righteousness, not regulate evil or minimize evil. So the question then becomes, who provides me the most opportunity to stand for righteousness where God has me in my life? And I think if we made arguments from positive constructs as opposed to negative constructs, then I think that we would do better. And again, I go back to this personhood town hall. We said, hey, here's the positive. You guys all say you're for life at conception. Now prove it to us. Here's what it looks like. Show us that you really mean it. And we compelled them, instead of saying, hey, you know what, you'll kill a few less kids than Barack Obama will, so that's just good enough for us. No, we said it's not, the standard isn't you versus Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
The standard is you versus the laws of nature and nature's God. That is the standard. You don't swear an oath to be better than Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
You swear an oath to uphold your oath of office before God. And I think that's what Christians need to get back to, is standing for transcendent standards. And also I would say this. If somebody like Mitt Romney wins the nomination, then I don't think you have a moral obligation. I've got to, like zombie Republicans, I've got to vote Republican.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he has to sell you as a voter, just like he has to sell every other undecided voter. We don't have any king but Jesus. We have
mm-hmm.
no allegiances ultimately but to Jesus. And the great irony of this is when Christians in history have lived that way, they've gotten, Kevin, as you well know if you know your church history,
yep.
we've gotten more out of the system living that way than we ever have playing nice with the system.
Exactly. Yeah, Calvin actually spoke about being in politics with that type of view in mind as being one of the highest callings that a man
mm-hmm.
could hold. And
mm-hmm.
so we've lost sight of that, of course, and really have just capitulated on a number of things. I got to let you go, Steve. I know you've got another interview up, but what happens if Ron Paul wins?
I think if Ron Paul wins, then I think it really matters who finishes third.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we'll punch at least three tickets out of Iowa. Your state, South Carolina, will become really the default line, and it will be Ron Paul and the sort of hybrid libertarian, constitutionalist versus the milquetoast establishment candidate in Romney.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever that third candidate is will sort of be the conservative grassroots alternative. And I think those three will square off in your state. What we don't know is who that third candidate is going to be. We'll find out January 3rd.
Great. Well, I'd love to have you back on as we get when we get here looking primarily here at South Carolina. But, Steve, thank you very much. Thank you for the work that you're doing there in Iowa, and thank you for taking the time out of your very busy schedule, I'm sure, this week to visit with us here on the Knowing the Truth radio program.
You're welcome. We love being on your radio station, and thanks for the time.
Okay, great. That was Steve Dace. Steve is a nationally syndicated radio talk show host. He's right there in Iowa. A number of the candidates, of course, go see him on a regular basis in order to talk about these issues. And he just hosted just the other day a really interesting event. And that interesting event was the program that he hosted called the Personhood USA's Presidential Forum, where they asked some really hard questions of the Republican presidential candidates. They asked them straight up front, where do they stand on this issue of life? Now, remember when Barack Obama was running for president 3 years ago, I remember a lot of Christians were a bit conflicted about what to do. I remember people were using statements like this. They were saying, you know what, you evangelicals, even fellow evangelicals were saying this. They were saying that we have become a one-person, one- or two-person issue. And basically, the issue that they were talking about was the issue about being pro-life. And they started to say that, you know, we need to broaden this out a little bit, more social justice type of approach. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to think about life other than just, you know, whether you're pro-life. Well, I would say, you know, as we see this, I think that that was quite a bit of capitulation on the part of the evangelicals. There was some frustration that we hadn't made the type of progress that we wanted to see. I could understand that, but what they did was they kind of lessened the viewpoint. What we just heard from Steve Dace, articulated from him, and what we see in his book that he has co-authored, is we see, wait a second, we shouldn't be loosening the reins there. We shouldn't be broadening the definition of what it means to be pro-life. We should be stating it and articulating that position even stronger, especially during the primary where we're looking at the different candidates. We shouldn't be trying to squeeze a candidate into that pigeonhole, if you will, or that category, but we should be asking them and getting them to articulate it very clearly. What do you mean when you say that you are pro-life? And specifically, what are you going to do in this pro-life issue? And so this is something that we really need to look at as Christians. Life certainly has to be something that is given by Almighty God. This is an inalienable right. It can't be taken away. No state can take this away from you. No individual can take it. The church, first and foremost, there should be a general consensus, even more than that, a 100% participation on those that name the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, that this is the number one issue. The issue is life. And so we need to really restate this again and really know our position well and stand up for it. Life in every situation. There is no situation that arises where we say that it is in that situation it is okay then to take the life of the baby. So this has been the historically pro-life position. This is certainly the historic Christian position that we should have on this issue. That should be first and foremost. And I applaud people like Steve Dace and the other folks there from the Personhood USA Presidential Forum for bringing this to light and really getting these men to sign these petitions again and pledges again. I'm not always in support of some of these pledges that were there. They had one come out about marriage as well, and it seemed a little bit awkward in that situation. The person has pledged before Almighty God that they will be faithful to their wife when they were married. In that marriage ceremony, it's a public ceremony. We say we are gathered here together in the sight of Almighty God and these witnesses. So they have already vowed before Almighty God that they will remain faithful to their wife. So in those situations, I think we can, you know, come up with additional pledges for them to make. Seems to be a little bit awkward. In this particular case, I think, you know, revisiting the and putting better wording here, personhood, in this particular pledge is something that is good for Christians to be involved in to better articulate our position and better see who's actually on board with that position as well. And so you can check out some of the issues that we talked about here with Steve Dace and go out to his website. His website is www.stevedace.com. That's Steve Dace. His last name is spelled D-E-A-C-E, D-E-A-C-E.com. And you can read about his book and also see some of the other posts that are out there as well. I think you would find it very interesting. Whatever the issue is, of course, we need to look at these from a biblical perspective. Jesus said this. He said that you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. We'll see you again right here on Knowing the Truth tomorrow.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.
Life-changing teaching and talk for the Carolinas and Georgia. Christian Talk 660. WLFJ Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson.